welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. Sorry for the pause. I couldn't find the volume switch here. So, that debt is fraud. It's now or never. And as you know, it's all about constitutional compliance. We've been going through the evolution of the Constitution. And in diving into the plans, I think it's imperative that we kind of help you see that there were... it's not like everybody thought the same way. So when the Virginia plan was presented, there were a few different plans that came forward trying to change this. And actually, most of those plans brought forward some fruit. And now we're going through the Sherman's Compromise, which is really the last plan that actually had an effect. And I say that because there's one more plan that we're going to actually get into, and that's Hamilton's plan. And everybody listened to Hamilton kind of go off, and we'll talk about that when we get there. But it was more of what Hamilton wanted to see than what they were doing. And so, in other words, he was basically being the contrarian in the room, kind of kept himself silent. And I think by this point in time, I believe his two brethren from New York ended up leaving the convention. So I think when we look at the voting, because when we looked at the voting just recently, the only vote was coming from Hamilton from New York. In other words, he had the full weight of the state. And so at this point in time, when he goes through his projecting his plan, at this point, he pretty much leaves the convention and is gone for weeks and does stuff. But we'll get into that when we get to the Hamilton plan. We're in the middle of the James Madison's notes, in the middle of the Roger Sherman plan, forgive me. And so we just kind of talked about the debts, foreigners, citizens, and so forth, and we kind of went into a tangent on that. And so the last part, there's just a few more paragraphs of the Sherman Compromise. So welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
No problem. No problem at all. So what I'd like is let's go ahead and have you pick up the 8th article of the Confederation, and then if there's something you want to talk about or if I want to interrupt, I guess you can just kind of wait a little pause and we can chew on something that obviously you might have covered. Thanks. Appreciate it.
All right, sir. That the 8th article of the Confederation ought to be amended agreeably to the recommendation of Congress of the blank day of blank, that if any state shall refuse or neglect to furnish its quota of supplies upon requisition made by the legislature of the United States, agreeably to the articles of the Union, that the said legislature be authorized to order the same be levied and collected of the inhabitants of such state, and to make such rules and orders as may be necessary for that purpose. That the legislature of the United States have power to make laws calling forth such aid from the people from time to time as may be necessary to assist the civil officers in the execution of the laws of the United States, and annex suitable penalties to be inflicted in case of disobedience. That no person shall be liable to be tried for any criminal offense committed within any of the United States in any other state than that wherein the offense shall be committed, nor be deprived of the privilege of trial by a jury by virtue of any law of the United States.
Adjourned. Now, okay, so what's the difference between a trial by jury and due process?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure. So due process means, because when you really look at the criminal process of trying somebody, that when we look, there's actually... a trial by jury is the ultimate where the facts get laid out. and where the verdict comes, by the jury instead of by a judge. Prior to that, if the crime is infamous, then something has to occur. And that's where an indictment from a grand jury must come first before you get railroaded into a trial by jury. So in other words, due process means that, one, there's this whole process of writing up a writ of arrest. You know, if they catch you in the crime, that's one thing. But if you're suspected of a crime and they're going to arrest you, then they have to have a warrant to do that. So the due process is the entire administrative legal process that has to occur prior to you go to that trial by jury, which means that before they can create a warrant, now sometimes today they will arrest somebody because they've given themselves the latitude, because somebody can flee the jurisdiction, they give themselves the latitude to arrest somebody, to hold them and wait, because you got a certain amount of time for a grand jury to convene, meet, go through the facts and provide the indictment. So they can hold you for whatever that time is, and that's a part of that right to a speedy trial as well. In other words, they can't drag that on to punish you while this, you know, this goat rope is going on for, you know, how many weeks, months, or what have you, to come up with an indictment while they can manufacture enough evidence. In other words, they give the grand jury enough time to basically subpoena information, to get data, facts, what have you, to come up with the indictment. Most of that stuff that is used in the grand jury is typically thrown into the trial by, or the actual trial by jury, your trial. So anyway, that due process is that entire process when somebody is under the threat of losing life, liberty, and or property. In other words, you're going to be fined, you know, a substantial amount of money. So that's the difference between just a trial by jury and due process. So anyway, because down the road they start thinking about, well, there's a little bit more than just a trial by jury. This is why in the Bill of Rights, they ensured to add the entire due process. The right of habeas corpus, those types of things. So anyway, anywho, so at this point they've adjourned. Now, on Saturday, they all go down to the pub and start talking. I'm just kidding. They actually work on Saturdays. The only day they don't work is the Sabbath. So they go into the Committee of the Whole on Saturday, and they go through some resolutions that were proposed by Mr., I believe it was Parsons, and Mr. Randolph. And this is where Mr. Lansing, and I believe... You know what? I'm going to need to pull it up because I don't remember Lansing. I thought for sure that Mr. Lansing was one of the delegates from New York. Am I right?
You're asking me.
Yeah. Okay, so let me go.
That's
look.
A good one.
Let me
That's
go
rich.
And so Lansing Jr. is from New York. And so I don't think that there were two Lansings. There were two... Pickneys, but there were only one Lansing. So, yes, I'm right. He was an anti-federalist, by the way. And so that's why, if you notice, I highlighted this in red. His comments was an anti-federalist comment going back to the commission. And I try to go out of my way to highlight every time the delegates brought up the commission, whether it was a myopic view or a view that was shared by everybody. And in many times we looked already to this point, and this is the first anti-federalist comment on the commission. There was one earlier that talked about, you know, trying to amend the Articles of Confederation. Remember, we talked about that. But in that same diatribe regarding the commission, they concurred with the concept of breaking up Continental Congress into three distinct branches, because they had the legislative, the judiciary, and the executive. So anyway, so Mr. Lansing goes into a tirade, or goes into, you know, a little oration regarding the commission. So let's pick this up.
Commission Anti-Federalists called for the reading of the first resolution of each plan, which he considered as involving principles directly in contrast. That of Mr. Patterson says he sustains the sovereignty of the respective states. That of Mr. Randolph destroys it. The latter requires a negative on all the laws of the particular states. The former only certain general powers for the general good. The plan of Mr. Randolph, in short, absorbs all power except what may be exercised in the little local matters of the states, which are not objects worthy of supreme cognizance. He grounded his preference of Patterson's plan chiefly on two objections against that of Mr. Randolph. One, want a power in the convention to discuss and propose it. Two, the improbability of its being adopted.
Okay. Anything for that?
One.
Go ahead.
He was decidedly of the opinion that the power of the convention was restrained to amendments of a federal nature and having for their basis the Confederacy in being. The Act of Congress, the tenor of the Acts of the States, the commissions produced by the several deputations all proved this. And this limitation of the power to an amendment of the Confederacy marked the opinion of the states that it was unnecessary and improper to go farther. He was sure that this was the case with his state, New York, and would never have concurred in sending deputies to the convention if she had supposed the deliberations were to turn on a consolidation of the states and a national government.
Okay.
Two, you want to go on that one?
So he's actually taking a hardline stand where they would not have allowed this to happen. But New York was one of the states that actually said, go address the, you know, whatever the exigencies are with the other states. And so technically, as I look at the commission, when he leaves because they decide to move forward, he basically is making the argument that having and deliberating with the other delegates of the other states to, you know, to ensure you create a system that meets the exigencies, you know, to preserve the union, then it doesn't say what he's articulating, that there is this hard requirement, because bottom line, they are making, one, a new government, and they're actually changing powers and everything else. They haven't even gotten to those points yet. They haven't even gotten to the points of where they really addressed the many problems, like the amendment problem. That was a huge problem in just making an amendment. There was no way that this... Okay, so let me try to give you this picture. The requirement of requiring all 13 states to make one punctuation change to the contract, to the Articles of Confederation. In other words, you got to have all 13 states to say, we agree. That right there was the death nail to the Articles of Confederation, and everybody in this room knew it. Everybody in this room knew it. There were those, like Rhode Island, that didn't care about the Union. They cared more about the power of their state that they possessed at that point in time, because they viewed themselves with enough power to protect themselves. This is where we start seeing this, and we very specifically see this in the little state, or the smallest of the powerful states, Massachusetts, where they literally use those words to say, we don't need the Union. I mean, if there was a state that was proud, you know, if you look, there was a tribe of Israel that really had a problem with its pride. What was that tribe?
Oh, I'm trying to think. Was it Dan?
No. It was the Hebrew, Judah, the tribe of Judah. They had a real pride problem where when Christ came along, they refused to accept him. They didn't need him. He wasn't the Messiah. As I look at the different tribes of Judah, or the tribes of Israel, Judah was the tribe that was kind of notorious for being headstrong, stiff-necked, and, you know, just unwilling to accept Christ and unwilling to, you know, accept the truth because Christ told them the truth. So anyway, here we have states, or I should say members of the states. Let's be clear here. There were members of these states, Massachusetts, New York, Virginia, and the reason why, and this goes to the scriptures as well, why do we have such voluminous scriptures? Why is the Bible so thick, my friends? It's because man didn't do well in following God's commands. And because we kept on failing, and because we had these problems, we needed more clarity, and that clarity came in the written word. And the written word was repeated how many times? You know, hey, I'm serious. You got to worship me. So, you know, all I can say is the reason why we have the voluminous works of the ratification debates had everything to do with these states that were trying to protect their cabals. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that's why Virginia, the states that were possessing the power, there were actors doing everything they could to kill this Constitution. In other words, their motives weren't righteous. Their motives weren't really looking at what was best for the people. It was what was best for their interest and their agenda. Period. Which is why they came up with these weak arguments. We need a Bill of Rights. We need this. We need this. You know, and oh, well, look at, and all of these, I'll just say, disingenuous assertions that this clause was going to do this, or that this clause was a general power, blah, 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 blah. And so that's one of the reasons why we have the voluminous works of the ratification debates. And so If you look at it this way, folks, the reason the Bible is so voluminous is we needed that word to help expound upon what, you know, what the truth of living, you know, God's commands, this gospel and so forth, what we needed to do. And when we got the voluminous information out of the state ratification debates, this is where they refuted all of these arguments of how if they did this, then, you know, this means this and this means. And if we read them, we can see exactly how the violations occurred, and they weren't legitimate violations, like the perversion of the militia, and how the federal government literally started undermining new states coming into the Union because we never heard much about the militias. They actually left the army, the cavalry, in place to provide, you know, and tend to them. They weren't developing. It should have been a criteria of statehood that the people had sufficient means of defending themselves with whatever potential threats and needs for their own security for that state. Then they would become a state. But they didn't do that. Because the people in Washington was looking at all these people they were employing, and all these people that they were employing wanted to keep this job so they could get a retirement and these benefits and so forth. And believe it or not, they actually started creating those things, because out of all of the employees of the federal government under the U.S. Constitution, at first, the only people that had any benefits beyond their time of service was the military. And you know why, right?
Why?
Because they put themselves in harm's way. I mean, they were the ones that were truly sacrificing. They didn't look at the people in politics as people sacrificing. These people were noble in coming in and helping execute the laws that this thing created. They weren't to have. That's why the Constitution never gave them any other benefits other than compensation for their time served, or compensation for their, when they had to go in an official capacity to travel, they would allow themselves compensation. But they had no right of a retirement plan, no rights of any other benefits. The only people that had benefits were the military. This all,
Principle, I don't agree with that, because once you serve, if you're not supposed to have standing armies, you're supposed to have a militia. You should only get paid for the time you serve.
Yeah, but there's still
you're creating something that it can
be right.
Influence.
Peace. There still is a military. It's called the United States Navy. They had a requirement of standing up and maintaining that Navy and protecting their commerce abroad. And they started using it to protect the commerce abroad. At least Thomas Jefferson did. But I get it. You're right. The militia was really a resource that was to be manned and controlled and maintained by the states at the expense of the federal government. And so, you know, the federal government kind of looked at it and go, you know what? This costs us some money, and if we go down this other path, we can, you know, benefit, still make, you know, still tax them the same amount of money, but we can benefit. But at you know, in the long run, it's at the expense of the states. And for some reason, the federal government didn't care. So let me go down this other path. Most people abhor this concept of, you know, property, poll taxes, and landholders, and you had to have property to vote and so forth, because those people today are the people of affluence, and the people without, you know, they just don't have it. They can't have it. Well, technically, back in those days, land was given out. Almost every new state that joined the Union was basically giving land out to get people to come out there to live. You know, to start growing food, bring some cattle out here and create a ranch and, you know, do this and do that and, you know, become a provider and sell your wares into the market and make a good living for you and your family in a place that they can grow up and live, you know, for generations. Okay, so today there's still enough land that homesteading can still be done. And as a matter of fact, all the federal land that has been used in the West or been absconded and confiscated, all of that should transition probably into homesteading. All the land that has been purchased by non-residents that have literally just basically waging economic warfare because all this farmland is being bought by Bill Gates or other people that are getting into the scheme, putting up these wind farms and so forth, you know, having a couple of windmills on the property, and they're only doing it so that they can scam their little, you know, kickback out of the program that the federal government created to fund this. In other words, we're paying through the teeth to have this crappy energy. So my point is, and I've said this to state legislators, and I've said this to party leaders, you need to create a law that says if land is being owned by anybody that is not, if that land does not have a resident on it or a business functioning, and or if that land that does have a business is not using that land, all open land is open for homesteading. And I said you may want to actually protect homesteading, because I don't think you need to really, unless you need to pull people in like Wyoming, some of the sparse states. But if you really need to, you know, attract people to move to your state, then you want to open it up for anybody that, you know, can come and create a homestead. But those places, Iowa, you know, maybe some of the other places, Nebraska, Kansas, those places that have been basically taken over by this economic assault of the affluent and the government, then those lands should be probably open for generational, in other words, a second generation, what do you call a person from Kansas? Kansonian? Anyway, a Kansanite?
Kansan.
A Kansan. Okay, thank you. So for a Kansan, if you're a second generation, in other words, your grandparents, you know, came to Kansas and your parents stayed and you stayed, then you could actually go set up a homestead. We can talk about this when we come back, of course, and get your ideas on this. But and let me close up on why this property thing is really important in understanding the perspective. So we will be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so if you want to create a society that basically has disdain for property rights, the only way you can do that is make it so that it's harder and harder to where you get a majority of the people in your society that do not have property rights. Then you can actually start moving away and making all property public. In other words, the government seizes all property. Nobody has property rights. And next thing you know, you have statism. And in America, this sacred thing called property rights became so protected that now you don't even have to reside in a state as long as you have money and you can come in and buy that land. And here's the interesting thing. The states may have property tax, but if the states actually get rid of property tax and go back to how it was originally, where property tax was voluntary. Now, I believe, and we've kind of talked about this, so I believe that a person should be able to vote for their representative, whether you have property or not. You need representation in government. But I also believe that if you don't have property, you should not be able to vote on those matters that deal with, you know, property taxes, levies, bonds, anything that has to deal with something that you don't own. You don't have a stake in it. You have no dog in that fight. Go away. You're not voting in these things. We have the ability today to actually provide a person a ballot based on their status as a property owner. Great. Then you can, you know, get these, you know, you can vote on these referendums, issues, what have you. And so if it is basically something for all people, but the other thing is there's some things we need to do, because we got to stop allowing things to get onto the ballot that are absolutely unconstitutional. We need to actually get rid of the legal stranglehold on the legislative process, because there's this squad of lawyers that review every bill that comes through, and they're the ones that bless it. If we go to what GR has been saying, your county needs a Constitutional Compliance Committee. Your state legislature needs a Constitutional Compliance Committee. And guess what? At the state level, that Constitutional Compliance Committee has to be that state legislature. And oh, by the way, folks, most state legislatures need to grow, because most capitals were created probably a century, if not more, ago, and there's no way people are getting adequate representation anymore. Remember, we've talked about this. If you're going to have a good government that's actually going to serve you, you need adequate representation, not what they're willing to give you because we're limited to chairs. We have the technology, folks, to allow junior members or what have you to, you know, to ensure that they, you know, can participate in everything virtually. And if there's meetings and so forth, they may have to drive in to participate in committee meetings. But when it comes to participating in the vote, everybody can do that virtually. My point is this, going back to property. that property used to be voluntary, that if you wanted to participate in the political process, other than voting for your representative, you had to pay a poll tax. In other words, if there's something that's going to go on the ballot that's going to say we need to have a levy for schools, what have you, and the state or the county is doing that, they're creating a levy so that they can do something, you know, have a water dam, whatever it is that they're trying to do for you, then it would be in your best interest to go and pay your property tax for that one cycle for the election, because that's what they did. It was voluntary. But property was basically for the people. For the people. Not for big entrepreneurs to come in and buy up all of the property. That would be unconscionable in the eyes of our framers. Allowing somebody to hoard and keep you away from being able to make any advancements in your life. Just because, you know, your parents didn't have enough money to, you know, buy you property or secure property or what have you. So let me pause. What do you think about this presentation or this paradigm that I'm kind of throwing out, regurgitating, whatever, however you want to call it?
I think that at this point in time, currently,
yeah,
in this generation, it's kind of a slippery subject to say that if you don't own property, then you don't get to vote on things that happen within your community.
Well, so
because even if you're renting or leasing or whatever, what have you, you know, or you're living on your family land, then you're not the owner of the property, so you don't get to vote.
No. So that's
here. We
so like, it's caveated.
Things that are done that have to do with property.
Sean, it's caveated. Like, it's caveated. You can't vote on taxes on property. Now, if it's something that does, you know, we want to add a district. We want to add, you know, more people. We want to have, let's say we want to have a public utility district. And we want to do that. But we're not putting a levy on taxing you. We've been growing and we can do this new utility or we want to do this or that. It's not associated to taxes. Then by all means, everybody should be able to vote on that. I'm just telling you that when you give those people that don't have property the ability to put a burden on those that do, that's how we create takers and makers.
I understand that, but at the same time, if you have a corporation that comes in and buys a property, and now they have an unfair advantage against the citizens to do things that might harm the community or people in the, and they have no
leverage. So corporations.
Corporation owns half of the county.
So corporations is a much broader subject because corporations right now are regulated by the federal government unconstitutionally. In other words, corporations, just like property, is a very broad subject that needs to be examined in its full breadth. So when it comes to property, if a corporation does come in, it's actually something that I would believe that a state and or a county would actually want and be very welcoming as long as that corporation was residing there. If it's just a toehold like Amazon, like a data center or something like that, nope, you can't put that there. We're here for you to build and function and operate here, but we're not here to just allow you to buy land and take our resources, period.
Yeah. There's actually legislation that they're working on right now.
Yes, I know. I had these conversations with Jerry Wistrand for Missouri, and I gave him the petition regarding property rights. So that we could actually look at, you know, this, you know, the sacredness of property, because non-residents should not be able to hold property. Residing corporate, if that's not a corporation that is fully regulated by the state, because it's a state corporation, then the state has a responsibility of actually having non-resident corporation taxes, requirements, regulations, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because what we need to do is we need to start dealing with this paradigm shift that the framers didn't fathom. They didn't fathom independent monarchs. Bill Gates is an independent monarch. The Rockefellers, the, you know, Carnegie, all of these different people that became so rich, they became monarchs. As we kind of move forward, most of these things that are kind of entwined, like property, I'm only looking at the property and voting style. I'm not looking at a corporation, because the corporation goes both into that as well as a lot of other things. And so, because they can easily start buying up resources that would be considered a disadvantage for the people, even though the state may make more money, it's not their job to make money at the expense of the people.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was going to ask you about some, whether the people of Virginia need to work on some new petitions, considering the new administration and their intent and agenda.
Yes. Okay. Well, so let's get back to this. I wanted your feedback on the homesteading, though. What did you think about that?
The homesteading? I'm sorry.
Yeah. In other words, if the state actually started opening up all this
stuff.
You love it?
I absolutely do.
Yeah.
40
yeah.
acres and a mule. I wish when I was in my younger years and some, you know, I could have gotten 40 acres and a mule. I would have put it to good use.
There we go. All right. So these are parts of what I put out called the Bill of Rights for the 21st Century, where states have this responsibility of protecting the new frontier of property, the new frontier of currency, the new frontier of marketing, or I should say market spaces, i.e., you know, I don't even know if I put it in, because this is one of those things that, you know, I mean to put into it, but I don't think I ever did this. But every state or every person that resides in a state other than New York and is invested in the New York Stock Exchange, you have no protection. In other words, the only reason there are regulations protecting you is because the federal government unconstitutionally is doing that. So I'm telling you that the state legislatures really need to start creating their own market system so that people are investing in their own state and building up their own state instead of continually building up this cesspool called New York. Or Illinois. If you look at where the stock exchanges are, they become cesspools because they're getting other people's money. But if the markets, these markets of investment, were contained within the states themselves and managed by themselves, then you may have some problems, because some states may be lackadaisical or, you know, corrupt, what have you. But you won't have the entire nation going into a economic nosedive, if you know what I mean, because the market collapsed, because it'll only affect that state. Plus, it creates the opportunity of people being able to invest in great ideas that help bolster the state and help improve the state. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I think what you're talking about grew out of the corruption of the Constitution and the overreach of the federal government.
Okay.
Because if they would have stayed true to the Constitution, what you're saying would have probably developed. And you'd have even more competition for ideas and, you know, ventures, because there'd be more competition.
Right. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, that's why Chicago has their own exchange, because they were doing so much trading in specific commodities and started opening up to different markets and so forth. They created their own market.
Right.
Okay. And there's other cities around, but I mean, it shouldn't actually be a city based either. It should be state based. And it should be basically, I mean, it's that, say you can't invest in New York. It's not to say you can't invest anywhere in the United States. Maybe not. I don't think we ought to be investing in foreign markets, though. Because I believe when we're investing in foreign markets, that is actually, I look at that as close to supporting our enemies. Until they become states in the United States, we should probably constrain, you know, people's investments in national investments because, one, we have no protection for them. The risk that they take, but two, the markets that they could be investing in. It's like Bill Gates invested heavily in the World Health Organization. That may not be a market, but he's absolutely supporting and buying into and controlling a government. That's why foreign investments really need to be constrained very significantly. I'm not the king, but I think that everybody ought to be looking at any type of foreign investment with sincere, strict scrutiny. That's the three S's. Severe, strict scrutiny. I like to throw words together with the same, anyway, whatever you call that. There's a word for that, I think, in poetry. But anyhow, let's get back to where you were.
All right. Number two, was it probable that the states would adapt and ratify a scheme which they had never authorized us to propose and which so far exceeded what they regarded as sufficient? We see by their several acts, particularly in relation to the plan of revenue proposed by Congress in 1783, not authorized by the Articles of Confederation, what were the ideas they then entertained? Can so great a change be supposed to have already taken place? To rely on any change which is hereafter to take place in the sentiments of the people would be trusting to too great an uncertainty. We know only what their present sentiments are, and it is in vain to propose what will not accord with these. The states will never feel a sufficient confidence in a general government to give it a negative on their laws. This scheme is itself totally novel. There is no parallel to it to be found. The authority of Congress is familiar to the people, and an augmentation of the powers of Congress will be readily approved by them.
Okay. So now Mr. Patterson gets up because he, you know, Lansing kind of was applauding or lauding Patterson's idea. He says, I kind of have, you know, I lean more towards that than Randolph's. And so we'll see how he addresses this. But the problem was that even though Congress produced acts, right, wrong, or indifferent, whatever he wants to say regarding those acts, Congress had no ability to enforce any of those acts, even those that they had the legitimate power to create. As a matter of fact, he didn't mention it, but Congress had the responsibility of making all treaties regarding aid or foreign aid. And New York was engaged in their own treaties foreign trade. Aid trade. I'm sorry, I'm tired, folks. Just cutting parts of the word off there. So as we look at, you know, what he was basically saying, he was trying to cast this dark cloud, but I don't think he was really shining the light all the way around the object here, due to the fact that the states were the ones that were literally, you know, ignoring the requisites or the what they were calling the taxation or these, you know, things. Hey, you need to give us this money. You need to do this. I mean, the states were obligated to do that, and they were ignoring them. There were only a few states, and most of those states were the southern states that were actually paying. And we learned, and I mentioned this before, and we'll find out soon, that the southern states kind of talked about how they need the union because some of those states, those three southern states, Georgia and the Carolinas, are so strapped, they're so deeply vested in slavery that they need the northern states to help fight their war. They can't afford to go on their own war as a state with some other nation. So that's why they were more than willing to help pay, you know, and fund the union, where these other states, Virginia, Massachusetts, well, actually, I think Virginia did pay, but Massachusetts, we know, didn't. So anyway, so Mr. Patterson gets up and kind of responds and gives his sentiments. Go ahead.
Mr. Patterson said, as he had on a former occasion given his sentiments on the plan proposed by Mr. Randolph, he would now avoid repetition, avoiding repetition as much as possible, give his reasons in favor of that proposed by himself. He preferred it because it accorded, one, with the powers of the convention, two, with the sentiments of the people. If the Confederacy was radically wrong, let us return to our states and obtain larger powers, not assume them of ourselves. I came here not to speak on my own sentiments, but the sentiments of those who sent me. Our subject is not such a government as may be best in itself, but such a one as our constituents have authorized us to prepare, and as they will approve. If we argue the matter on the supposition that no Confederacy at present exists, it cannot be denied that all states stand on the footing of equal sovereignty. All, therefore, must concur before any can be bound. If a proportional representation be right, why do we not vote so here? If we argue on the fact that a federal compact actually exists and consult the articles of it, we still find an equal sovereignty to be the basis of it. He reads the fifth article of Confederation, giving each state a vote, and the 13th declaring that no alteration shall be made without unanimous consent. This is the nature of all treaties. What is unanimously done must be unanimously undone. It was observed by Mr. Wilson that the larger states gave up the point not because it was right, but because the circumstances of the moment urged the concession. Be it so, are they for that reason at liberty to take it back? Can the donor resume his gift without the consent of the donee? This doctrine may be convenient, but it is a doctrine that will sacrifice the lesser states. The large states acceded readily to the Confederacy. It was the small ones that came in reluctantly and slowly. New Jersey and Maryland were the two last, the former objecting to the want of power in Congress over trade. Both of them to the want of power to appropriate the vacant territory to the benefit of the whole. If the sovereignty of the states is to be maintained, the representatives must be drawn immediately from the states, not from the people, and we have no power to vary the idea of equal sovereignty.
Okay, so right there, so hold on here. I want to inject this, because this goes back to that original struggle that persists throughout the convention. And so, in other words, Patterson's problem, and he says that this has everything to do with their commission, and actually he's wrong. He's grandstanding to basically try to maintain for one agenda. His agenda is different than Mr. Lansing's agenda. And he's right, because he admits it right here, that the smaller states, New Jersey being one of them, was very reluctant in getting drawn into a confederation creating a general government. Because small states recognize that, and that's why they're very apprehensive in this Constitutional Convention, which is why they piped up with this plan. And because they basically wanted, and they pushed back so ardently, that's basically said, hey, you know, if it's not based on states and equality, full equality, unanimity, all this stuff, then we're out of here. Delaware stated that and so forth. So why is it all of a sudden New York said, we prefer that, we want that? Because it protects their paradigm of supremacy not in the Union, but in the state of New York. In other words, they were actually saying and kissing the rest of the Union goodbye, because we're not going to abide by anything. Because the Articles of Confederation, said it time and time again, was inept and impotent. The Continental Congress was inept and impotent. They had a government that could not govern. And so there's a reason why the little states liked it, because it gave them some security to think that the big states were a part of it, but the big states had already abandoned it, if that makes sense, because they were already creating their own treaties. They were already ignoring and doing what they wanted to do. And so, for the most part, I see this, and I wanted to point this out, that this is the prevailing idea that state sovereignty needed to be maintained. And what ends up happening as they move forward is they literally create a constitution unlike any constitution ever, specifically delegating very finite powers. That they can only do these things. They cannot meddle in anything else, and therefore everybody agreed, for the most part, except for these hardcore, you know, cabal supporters like Lansing. I don't think he ever came back. Hamilton came back, but Hamilton had a completely different agenda, and we'll expose that. But the point is this, is that we see at the very end of the convention, based on the compromises that they had to put, those compromises, those 2 points were basically a huge illumination of the 2 contending points in Article 5 with the amendment protection clauses, because there are 2 amendments that could not be made to the Constitution. One, to wipe out the state sovereignty control over the Senate, that the state legislatures would always maintain their suffrage without, you know, unless they gave up their suffrage by their consent. And so when we look at the 17th Amendment, that didn't do it. The other amendment protection clause was to ensure that even though the slavery was injected into the Constitution, the slave trade must close in 1808. So those 2 contentions were addressed to ensure that, because the states that were against slavery, which was all of them except for 3, said, hey, we want an assurance that this slave trade is going to get shut down. So they made sure that they added that to the Article 5, and then the small states jumped up and said, we want a protection to make sure that we will never lose our equal suffrage. Aha! This is why there were only 2, because these were the 2 prevailing problems that they dealt with. And they used these things as excuses. And this is where I'm getting back to how this was deceitful. Congress came out with basically asking for a blank check. And all of the state legislatures, right, wrong, or indifferent, followed that blank check. In other words, they literally wrote what Congress wrote. And if they say that the state's commission was very specific from that state, if you go back to Congress and say, what did you mean by that? Oh, everything's on the table. Change whatever you need to. Even get rid of the Articles of Confederation. Because those operating in the Continental Congress were suffering, and they saw this government literally just evaporating. And so they wanted to make sure that this convention would be able to solve their problem and create a government that had the energy to sustain itself. So with that, we kind of ran out of time. So when we come back, we will pick up right there where we left off. And so any comments, Sean? You got a few seconds. Sorry.
No, sir.
Okay, great. So if you do have some comments, I'm actually interested. So before we get started next time, I'm going to ask Sean if he could give me, you know, any feedback regarding my analysis of how these commissions came down and how these 2 different things were being, I'll just say, being conflated by the big cabal protectors. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.